good to see a lot of faces and a lot of people that I know, and it's a good chance to reconnect. And that I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the current challenges, and they're mainly funding challenges that we've got and accountability challenges. And I will try to do the best I can do in terms of describing the situation that we see, kind of a path forward, I'll try to be as clear as I possibly can be. I mean, I think we're in pretty challenging times right now, and I think that we need to really work closely together to make sure that we get through with programs that are stronger rather than not as strong, and programs that can do more rather than that can do less, and programs that can take advantage of the Affordable Care Act. So what I'd like to cover here, and in keeping with kind of a sober theme, I got no bicycle photos in my talk at all today, and it's unfortunate because it would spice it up a little bit. Although where's Caitlin? And so her injury was not from a bicycle, it was from rock climbing, I understand, but she's a world-class mountain bike rider, and I thought, you know, being on a four-wheel kind of tricycle is not the best for you, but be that as it may. So I'll provide a funding update, and this what we see right now, we're still under a continuing resolution. Four vaccine financing challenges that we have right now: limitations of discretionary vaccine funding, assuring that SCHIP is not supported by the VFC program. Deputization, I think, is going to come to a head this year. I'll talk about that a little bit. And some provider-level accountability challenges. A little bit on sort of future childhood program in Section 317 opportunities. And I'd like to call your attention to Melinda Wharton's talk. Melinda, our deputy director at the National Center, and she'll be talking at the 11 a.m. Featured session tomorrow, along with Gary Urquhart, and talk about future program. And then finally, a little bit on transition from where we are to where I think we need to be, and then hopefully we'll have some good time for discussion. So the funding update, and these slides, and Claire, we always make these slides, so we always make these slides available, and I think they tend to get posted on the web, and so you'll have access to the numbers. And so this is an update from the November talk at the program managers meeting, and let's see, does the pointer? Yeah. Okay, so here's the funding that we had in FY02. These are all sources: new, carryover, pan flu, era funding, and then the total funding. They're the sum of that. This is operations. And in FY11, the minimum and the maximum, they're starting to converge. There's a little bit more carryover than we had in the previous year, and I think some of that may be due to ERA funding as an example, but there is a little bit more carryover. We don't know if we're going to get the pan flu funding. We assume that we will. We have been asking the question. We, you know, as in terms of internal CDC, the decision is to continue to fund this pan flu funding, and so we anticipate getting that. Under a CR, the influenza coordinating unit is not willing to say, yes, this funding is going to be here, because technically they can't. I think that's a fair statement, right, Sonia? I'm looking at Sonia is our FMO analyst, and so they really can't say they won't. My complete anticipation is that they will get funded and that you will get funded as a result of that. So the minimum, if the pan flu money does not come through, the minimum we're looking at now is around $291.7 million, maximum $309. That compares with $302.8 that we had last year, and the positive difference is primarily reflected from a little bit of carryover from 09 to 10, or for 08 to 9 that gets awarded in 11. No, 9 to 10 that gets awarded in 11, sorry. And then the VFC operations funding, there's very little difference between what was said at the program managers meeting in here. We're anticipating about $77.7 million in here. And then Section 317 operations funding, where we've divided it into new money, the DA other, DA personnel and travel, carryover. So again, a little bit more carryover than we had the year before. We think it's going to be around 14.7. It could be a little bit higher. A couple other, I think Melissa, a couple other FSRs to that may be coming in with some older money, and so we'll have to see how that works out. But I think the important thing for the operations funding is that we had a couple of consultations with you all, and especially with your elected leadership and with the executive committee, asking the question, if the program has to take a cut and we have to go back to, for example, 2008 levels, where would you take the cut from? And the answer is always has been consistently, if we have to take a cut, it should come out of vaccine, because maintaining operations funding has been critically important for your all program. That's consistent with the Institute of Medicine message, that the ebb and flow of operations funding has been damaging to the program. And if people disagree with sort of that and that consultation, you know, let us know. But if you're in, you know, I'd be curious to hear. I mean, we've been hearing that answer consistently. We're scared to death about losing operations funding and support that. So projected cuts that may come to the program are all coming out of vaccine and none coming out of operations funding. And so we think these numbers are solid. I believe that everybody got their funding levels from the project officers.
If they were in the office late on Friday.
Okay, and so your project officer's here, and so who, you know, you'll be able to get that information. But the principle was to try to maintain that operations funding level. And that was also, I think a lot of you must have been here for Tricia Schmidt's talk yesterday from OMB, and she had talked about, you know, seeing 317 going forward, how vaccine is probably going to go down, but I think she's recognizing the need to have this operations funding stay strong. And one of the key messages, I think, for why we need operations funding is that the operations funding not only supports the 317 program and the 317 priorities, but it really helps to steer the entire VFC program. It's implemented as a blended program, and so now you have $3.5 billion of vaccine purchase on a very small base of VFC operations, but the 317 helps to augment that, and I think that's kind of a key point. But anyway, so that's the operations funding. The allocation of operations funding, as you know, we have a formula, but we're implementing the formula slowly over a period of time. It's going to take years and years to get where we want to be, but we're getting there. And so what this shows is the percent difference from what would be termed an equitable funding based on those principles that were really set up around 8 or 9 years ago that have to do with basically population size, capacity of the program, some performance of the program in terms of coverage. It's largely driven by population. So if we had funded it just basically as they were funded last year with everybody getting a proportionate increase in funding, this is what it would have looked like. However, what we've worked out over the years is that even in times when there's a little bit more money or in times when there's essentially no more money in the system, that the relatively overfunded grantees could get up to a 5% cut. The relatively underfunded grantees would be able to get more money that way, and that's one way that we can, over time, achieve a more equitable funding base. And so this slide here shows what the actual funding amounts were relative to what would be an equitable amount. So there's one state that's sort of relatively overfunded to, here we go, a pointer, somewhere in the 75% range. And had we not implemented the formula, it would have been around 80% range. And so, again, being able to drop down about 5% a year over time. So you'll see, if you look in here, had we not tried to get more towards an equitable funding, that there's a large number of sort of minorly underfunded grantees in here, and with what we have here, there's a lot more, there are fewer of them. The fewer of the bars here below zero line, the relatively underfunded ones, and you can see everybody number who were kind of overfunded in this increment really kind of paid off. So I think this year we're getting a bit of a move towards more equitable funding, and we're getting several percent more funds coming through to the program, assuming the PAN flu money comes through. Okay, questions on that? Okay, VFC vaccine funding. This table here is one table, but I think it's easier just to see it in the chart. From 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, here's what our funding looks like. You can see that the 317 funds are relatively small amount on top of the giant VFC program. What this does not show is the mid-session review results with OMB. In June, we'll go to OMB and see. We may need a little bit more funding, and if so, then that picture will change a little bit for next year. Right now, it looks like we're going to need a little bit more funding in the vaccine line, and we'll probably be able to request that at mid-session review. We'll have to see how that goes. But the vaccine funding, I mean, this really illustrates the point about VFC being able to increase with the need, 317, a much smaller amount, relatively smaller amount, and pretty much static. And this year, we think it may be going down. And that leads me to four vaccine financing challenges. And so the first one is that I think that the discretionary funding for vaccine has really failed as a VFC gap filler. So for the last 10 years, or more than that, actually, there's been, you know, the Section 317 program. Melinda will be talking a lot about that tomorrow. It's basically been trying to fill this underinsured gap in the program, a structural gap in the VFC program that FQHCs and RHCs are not really able to fill. And underinsured population is around 11% of young children. It's around 20% of teenagers. It's been relatively static, although we want to see those numbers start to go down now. But I think a big challenge is that discretionary funding has really failed as a VFC gap filler. So I'd like to walk through that a little bit. 317, I mean, it's been there for a number of different purposes. It started out, as you heard, I don't know if anybody heard Dr. Fagy talk last night. I mean, talk about inspiring. Anyway, so it started off with polio, then measles, rubella, back to polio, and then when the Section 317 program really changed fundamentally and really dramatically when VFC started in 1994 with a program emphasis squarely and completely, almost completely on children. And so the primary use for Section 317 after that time, after 1994 when VFC was implemented, has been to fill that structural gap in the VFC program, underinsured children outside of the FQHCs and RHCs that are authorized by law to use VFC vaccine. I showed this slide at the program managers meeting, but I want to just sort of reiterate it. It's exactly the same as it was then. And it's the changes between 2001 and 2010 contrasting Section 317 annual changes with VFC annual changes. Now, VFC, as everybody knows, it grows with the need. When ACIP says there's a new vaccine, the funding is provided virtually automatically. Sonia Robinson knows this. We're on calls with Office of Management and Budget. We establish bona fide need that we get from you all in terms of our vaccine estimates and what was used last year. OMB has been very, very good to this program, and they provided the vaccine funding that we've needed every single time that we've asked. And so when you take a look at that, though, between 2001 and 2010, Section 317 increased by $48 million, and over that same period of time, VFC increased by $2.5 billion. And so the percent increase, over that 10-year time period, the percent increase for 317 was 24%, so it went up. But VFC went up 423%, or basically over a fourfold increase in VFC compared with a 24% increase in Section 317, and the annual increase in Section 317 was about, on average, $5 million a year. The average annual increase in VFC was $288 million a year. So it's as if every single year for the last 10 years we got something bigger than the whole 317 program added on top of the VFC program. It's amazing, you know, what an entitlement can do. On the other hand, this entitlement is so precious, we have to be very, very careful that we don't jeopardize it, because if we lose this entitlement, then, you know, that, I mean, it basically is the childhood program, and that's the kind of the theme of a lot of the rest of my talk in here. Now, just the other thing that I think is interesting is what's down there in the fine print is that the percent change in the cost to fully vaccinate a child from 0 through 19 years of age during this VFC age period increased by 362%. So you can ask yourself the question, well, all right, if Section 317 and state funding kind of paralleled 317, didn't keep up quite the same pace, but, you know, state funding that, you know, not all the states put in state funding, but, you know, there was some increases in state funding, but not quite as much as 317. But if state or 317 funds went up 24% and the cost to reach this sort of finite population that's not growing but it's not shrinking went up 362%, well, where is that money coming from? And so then when you say, well, what about VFC, it's gone up 423%, which is even more than the price of the vaccines to vaccinate this population that itself is not really growing very much. So the concern is that there may be yet some, you know, at least aggregate or ecological evidence that we've got a problem with, you know, with vaccine leaking out of the VFC program. And so that's the biggest concern that I think all of us share. So Section 317 can't fill the underinsured childhood gap. The 10-year pace of need, so measured essentially by VFC and the cost to vaccinate, has been 10 times the growth of Section 317 funding. The size of the underinsured population didn't shrink. We measured it with the NIS in 2000-2001. We measured it in 2009. For young children, it's been around 11%, pretty much constant in here. Now, I say VFC-induced new vaccines. Now, the VFC program is a great friend of children. It has caused more vaccines to be made and developed because there's a guaranteed market, but this puts all of that pressure on discretionary funding. So VFC-induced new vaccines, and you can list them all off, starting with, you know, varicella, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, rotavirus vaccine, meninge, HPV, TDAP, hepatitis A, universal, second dose, varicella. These were all kind of enabled by having this entitlement program, but it's created an ever-widening need for discretionary funding because you've got a constant gap, funding coverage is maintained high, and the cost to provide vaccines for all of these children has increased by about 3.6% times. And so the implication is that we really kind of need to abandon this thinking that discretionary funding is ever going to fill the VFC gap. It's been a 10-year struggle where every year we say, you know, the number of children that can be vaccinated with 317 is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and it is, yet coverage, and, you know, this is, you know, coverage has stayed high in this country. And so how does that happen? Well, it's not clear, but it has. And so the fact is that discretionary funding has probably not really been what's filled in that gap. We need a more realistic strategy than saying we need to have more 317 funding for vaccine because it's not likely to happen on the discretionary side. And we need a strategy that will use the Affordable Care Act. And so I'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, that's challenge one. So this is, and then I've got three more. But they're shorter, though. So the other is SCHIP can't use VFC vaccine. So Child Health Insurance Program created in 1997, reauthorized in 2009, and it's administered by CMS on the Medicaid side. There's a division that administers CHIP. It's within Medicaid. MCHIP and SCHIP, or combination plans that states could decide, and you all could, your state was able to decide whether it's going to be Medicaid expansion, separate CHIP, or a combination in here. The vaccine rules were set by the CHIP Steering Committee back in 1998. That the Medicaid expansion CHIP children are entitled to VFC, the SCHIP and the SCHIP part of combo plans, children are not entitled to VFC vaccine. They're not eligible that vaccine, but the SCHIP plans are required by CMS regulation that they have to cover all the ACIP recommended vaccines with no copay and no deductibles, similar, pointing out here, to what the Affordable Care Act says of private insurance. And so this is kind of an interesting model to take a look at. The SCHIP children, however, were allowed to be declared state-eligible children for the use of the VFC contracts to buy vaccine at discounted prices. This is a letter that's in your VFC operations manual, and it's in three sections. I won't read through this first part. Just gives a little bit of background on SCHIP. But the second part is here, I think, is very important. Children who are newly eligible for Medicaid under Title 21 are federally vaccine eligible, as are all other children eligible for Medicaid. But because Title 19 restricts restricts ineligibility for VFC, states have designated a separate state health insurance plan, or SCHIP, may not treat children enrolled in such a program as federally vaccine eligible. In other words, not eligible for VFC. But then they do talk about being able to use the reduced price contracts in here. And the letter goes on. I kind of urge everybody to read this. It's on our website in the VFC operations manual in here. And it talks about what can be done with a state-eligible child in here. But there are some important implications on this CHIP steering committee decision. Now, it would have been a lot, I think, easier to make these children back in 1998 eligible for the VFC program. That was not done. The CHIP steering committee elected not to do that. And so one of the implications of this decision is that SCHIP can never be considered under insurance. By regulation, they have to cover every ACIP-recommended vaccine, and they cannot be vaccinated with VFC vaccine, and so they're a very kind of special class of children in a certain sense, because they have by definition, non-under insurance vaccine or full insurance coverage. So VFC can't be the ultimate purchaser of vaccine for SCHIP children. Rather, SCHIP vaccine is to be purchased by SCHIP programs. And the letter from Medicaid spells that out, saying that the intent is that the funds are bought by SCHIP. Use of the VFC contracts poses substantial accountability challenges. And the question is, what's really the exact right amount of vaccine? These children have different age structures than Medicaid, different age structures in the general population. That becomes important because infants use a whole lot more vaccine than 7-year-olds. And, you know, Medicaid has a much higher infant enrollment rate than SCHIP that sits on top of Medicaid is. And so there's a lot of challenges in here in the age structure in here. So the question is, what's the right amount of vaccine for SCHIP to be purchasing in your state? And even having immunization programs supply SCHIP vaccine has accountability challenges if the vaccine is VFC vaccine until proven otherwise. And there are a couple of different ways that it may be proven otherwise, for example, by entering into a registry or into a bill for an administration fee. But that means that there's challenges if a dose is administered and it's not entered into a registry or a bill's not cut for the administration fee. So there's potential accountability problems in here. So, and it's not so much a true confession, but maybe it's a true confession. Back in 1998, this decision said CHIP's not part of VFC. Here's some guidance. Go forth and do good. CHIP's an important program. And it really wasn't on my radar screen. I thought that things were kind of going swimmingly and things were fine. And I know the states were working on this. And there was a lot of children in Medicaid expansion, a lot of children in SCHIP. SCHIP's really not part of the program. And I had not really been paying that much attention to SCHIP. Well, SCHIP has been growing. It's a popular program. And now it has 7.7 million children, which compares with 30-some million children for Medicaid. So it's quite a large program. And interestingly, about 5.5 million of those children are in separate CHIPs, not in Medicaid expansion. So the most popular model is a separate CHIP program in here. Now, these are the ever-enrolled figures. And so on an average, there are fewer children in here. And that'll become important when we have more dialogues about how to account for SCHIP vaccine. And I think I had. And so on the CMS website, one of the beauties of SCHIP, so in contrast to any other kind of insurance other than Medicaid, SCHIP, you can know the rules. It has to cover all the vaccines that ACIP recommends, and you have enrollment figures. And so that's in contrast to any other kind of insurance plan that really meets these requirements. And so you will know how many children are enrolled in your state, and you can find out the age structure of the state. And so I think that's going to be one of the biggest benefits in terms of trying to make sure that SCHIP pays its way. And so this is just from the CMS website. It shows the number of children in state by state on a point-in-time estimate, which I think is a pretty accurate way to look at things, of SCHIP, the percent on SCHIP, Medicaid expansion, and the percent, and then the total. So, and I titled this, "As Far From Hopeless." I mean, I think that one of the challenges that we had is realizing that SCHIP has grown, realizing that there may be challenges in accounting for all the vaccine, realizing that VFC vaccine may be being used for SCHIP children, that we need to do something about it. But I don't think it's going to be, as I say here, it's far from hopeless. I don't think it's impossible. I think that we can reasonably come to a way that we move this forward. So the recommendation that I've got here is that you all, if you have an SCHIP program, and I think there's only 7 states that are purely Medicaid expansion, so pretty much everybody here, it would be very helpful to meet with your SCHIP program director. Oftentimes this is administered in your state in Medicaid. It may be in the same part. You know, it's going to vary a lot. And we need to take a look and see, kind of trace the vaccine and how it works to ask the question, is SCHIP completely separated from VFC? If federal vaccine is being used as the initial source of SCHIP vaccine, is the program being reimbursed completely? Is there a system in place for verification? So I think what we'll want to do eventually is, if it's a billing reimbursement system, then to have an independent verification looking at the point in time enrollment estimate to make sure that it's a reasonable amount. We've had calls with around 8 or 9 states, and there's a lot of variations on how it's done, and there's some challenges in how it's done, and I think that we can work together to come out with a way that we can independently model what the right amount should be and have ways that you'll feel comfortable that your program is getting reimbursed if you're putting out VFC vaccine until it's proven otherwise, it's proven to be SCHIP, which I think is a challenging model. And so we want to work this through with the project officers. Should I keep going? Okay, that's two challenges to go. First I need to go the right direction. All right. So deputization. Now, we've changed the term. Instead of calling it delegation of authority, on the advice of the CMS attorney and other attorneys that were in the conversations, they say, you know, deputization is a more accurate term, and so we call this deputization of a VFC provider to act as an FQHC or an RHC for purposes of giving vaccine to underinsured children. Well, we've had lots of discussions of this over a period of time. So the current position that we have at CDC is that we're aware of these deputization arrangements. We provide no guidance on them. What it means to say that we're aware of them is that if we are aware that these are happening and we are honoring these, then we don't believe that they're illegal. And that's a pretty low bar when you think about it. But if we thought that they were, if all right, it's a very low bar. Okay. If we were told that they were illegal, we would have to put a stop to it. We don't believe, you know, so we've not been told that they're illegal, and so we honor these deputization arrangements. We don't provide guidance because we don't want to, up until now we haven't really been wanting to ask the question, is it legal or not, but now we have to ask that question, and we are in the gray area of law. We don't really know the status of this. The deputization arrangements in the states vary. It's unregulated. If we don't provide guidance, how is it going to be regulated at all? It's confusing. There are different constituencies that like it and don't like it. Some of the arrangements are very sweeping. They provide no incentive for insurance to pay for vaccines. In other words, if anybody can be deputized in the state for under insurance, why would an insurance company want to provide vaccines at all? They would just use VFC vaccine. And so these sweeping ones are just probably way too sweeping to do it. And I think this confusion really impedes planning. If you have difficult and challenging programs to plan moving forward, how are you going to do that if we don't have guidance and it's all confusing? Now, the Affordable Care Act did not touch VFC. We were thinking for quite a while that healthcare reform was going to expand VFC into health department clinics. It didn't do that. It didn't touch VFC. And you know, there had been a proposal since 2003 to do just that. That proposal has really been removed. There's no longer a legislative proposal for the VFC program at all. Ultimately, the Affordable Care Act removes the need for deputization by basically banning underinsurance. Now, that ban takes a while to be implemented. I think we've been hearing throughout the conference that nobody knows how long it's going to take before underinsurance goes away, and the private insurance plans are really paying their way, and that 11% and 20% of young children and teens are covered by reliable health insurance. And this takes time as these grandfathered plans become ungrandfathered. So deputization of VFC providers as FQHCs and RHCs, some future possibilities. In 2008, there was a working group that was formed. CDC, HRSA, CMS are developing programmatic options for deputization. And these are options that would be cleared through all three agents in the Office of General Counsel for ultimate HHS approval. And what we're seeking in this is the ability to provide department-wide guidance on deputization. And we're attempting to resolve that this fiscal year. The work group was formed in 2008. There really was thinking that VFC would be expanded by law. It wasn't expanded by law. This work group is really the next, you know, the next thing to happen. And so it became much more active last year. It's gotten to the point where it's looking like there's guidance that's palatable to HRSA. The attorneys need to clear this. There's a lot of hurdles. And so the potential, so the actual outcome is not known. There are sort of two what I think are real, are potential outcomes. One is that I'm hoping that will not happen, and that is that deputization may be banned. It may not. It may be deemed illegal. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's a possible outcome. And so I just kind of want to put it out there because the Office of General Counsel has not completely weighed in on it. There has been some letters from General Counsel, and they say right now it remains a policy option, but they preferred that it be sorted out by Congress, and Congress didn't do that. And so this guidance would have to be cleared by the Office of General Counsel. The next is that if we are allowed to have guidance, that we want to, then the guidance will change the current practice. I mean, if it's unregulated and all over the place, then it's going to have to be less unregulated. And we have to figure out what are we really trying to accomplish with this. So probably we'll end up limiting deputization to a smaller number of safety net providers with the goal of trying to do one of two things. One is that if there's areas in the state that have no FQHCs and RHCs, how are these entitled underinsured children going to get their VFC vaccine? Well, there has to be some way for that to happen, and deputization is a possibility. If there are FQHCs in an area, but the FQHCs are not seeing walk-in patients, they're not taking anybody, you know, anybody else, and their capacity is exceeded, how are these children going to get their vaccine? And so ideally then, you want to have some compelling case be made that by geography or capacity, there needs to be some deputization of providers to help reach these otherwise entitled VFC children who can't get the vaccine by geography or access. And the most clear-cut example places almost every place, I know it's not every place, and we're Susan, so not every place has public health department clinics, but public health department clinics are the logical choice for this. Places that do not have public health department clinics may have another safety net provider or group of providers that would be willing to serve walk-in patients, that would be willing to extend the VFC program out to these children that are not their patients, that are underinsured patients. So that's another possibility in here. But the basic idea is with guidance, we could end up having a bridge from where we are now, where we know 317 is not going to cover the underinsured, where we've got all these underinsured children that haven't been covered by health plans that the Affordable Care Act is going to do something about, until we can get to the point where they all have insurance, and that's going to take several years. And so deputization ideally can serve as that bridge. The last challenge on vaccine is provider-level accountability needs to be strengthened. And this is just a one-slide point. I think everybody knows that this is a challenge. VFC program, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn close to perfect. It was designed to reduce missed opportunities, so point of service eligibility determination is sort of a bedrock part of this program. Just the mere answering of these questions can entitle a child to a $106 dose of vaccine. There's no requirement for independent verification, and requirement can be difficult when it's attempted. For example, what we've been finding when we've been talking to the SCHIP states that buy off the federal contract is that the card looks just exactly like the Medicaid card. And so that's not easy for saying, all right, well, which source of vaccine am I supposed to use? And so the eligibility determination can be a huge challenge. The other sort of a math problem is that there's 44,000 providers. There's 61 of you VFC grantees, 64 if we include all the 317 grantees, and there's one CDC. So we, as a collective group of public health army, how are we really going to manage this provider-level accountability when there's so many providers and there's so few of us in here? The other is a challenge that anytime a child is turned away, it's an ethical tension. You know that these vaccines save lives. And how do you do that? And several years ago, when Claire and Grace Lee's and Jeannie's article came out, and Susan, I think you were on this in JAMA, that talked about underinsurance as a big as a gap for the program. I mean, it's a very, very real problem. It's not going to be solved by increasing Section 317, but there was a reporter, Gardner Harris in the New York Times, and he thought this is really a very compelling story, and he said he wanted to interview some parents who were getting turned away at health department clinics, because when you read that article, there are thousands, millions of children getting turned, well, hundreds of thousands of children getting turned away. And so nobody was willing to say that, yeah, you can come to our health department and interview some parents that have got turned away. Not a single clinic in the whole United States would say that. So what does that mean? So either protecting confidentiality of the patients that are in the clinic, or kids aren't really necessarily being turned away. I mean, who really knows? And so, but it was very difficult to really find that, you know, that person to interview. And Gardner Harris's article probably would have helped the community say, well, wait a minute, here's a child, they're going to get turned away. What happens now? As the providers, you all know that if a child gets turned away from vaccine, they show up with that particular disease, that doesn't mean there's not going to be a lawsuit for failure to vaccinate. You know, I mean, this is a very real ethical tension. But the wake-up call that we got was in this Inspector General study of storage and handling, nothing about accountability, but storage and handling, and they asked a very innocent question. They said, first, tell us the five top states for using VFC vaccine, because that was their scope of practice, was studying VFC. So we told them who they were. And they say, give us a list of all the VFC providers and how many doses of VFC vaccine they all got. And we go, well, that's going to be kind of tough. And we don't think that the states are going to be able to say that. And after back and forth and all this, nobody could say that. And so I think that we have the Inspector General saying, well, wait a minute. You've got this program. It's an entitlement program. And you have all these 44,000 providers, and you've got vaccine going in there. But you can't tell me how many doses of vaccine that Panorama Pediatrics has in Rochester, New York, and said, well, no, we can't do that. So improving provider-level accountability is a challenge that we have to face and find a way to do better, and I won't dwell on that anymore. So looking forward, on Affordable Care Act, immunizations, and health insurance, I mean, this was another slide from my program manager's talk, and you know this, that the key provision in ACA is that private insurance has got to pay its way. And if you take a look at that, so here's our current situation for young children, privately insured in here, Medicaid over here, uninsured over here, American Indian, Alaska Native in here. Here's this little wedge of underinsured children getting vaccines at federally qualified health centers or rural health clinics, and here's this big group of underinsured children. This is the challenge. And then you take a look, now I changed the colors, which is not fair, but this was that gray group that was underinsured. Sorry about that. And if you take a look, where do these underinsured children go? Most of them go to private docs. And probably most of them pay out of pocket for the vaccine. And then 15% of these underinsured children go to health department clinics. That is what that legislative proposal was meant to address. So it's not a huge population, but it's very real. But most of the kids go to private providers. So when we take a look at what are the long-term sources of pediatric vaccines now, I think for children, there's just two sources. Now, long-term is, say, 5 years from now and beyond. VFC and private insurance. Ultimately, there's really nothing more that should be needed for children in the United States. The law says that the insurance companies have to cover vaccines. VFC was unchanged. If there's a child with no health insurance, they're VFC eligible. If a child's on Medicaid, they're VFC eligible. American Indian, Alaska Native. So VFC and private insurance should do it. Fully insured should get their vaccine at private providers, at health department clinics that bill insurance plans, FQHCs and RHCs that bill insurance plans. The Medicaid uninsured American Indian, Alaska Native children, VFC from any VFC provider. Section 317 vaccine, I think Melinda is going to talk a bit about this, could then in theory be repurposed. It no longer has to be this big struggle to fill this gap that has failed to fill for 10 years of trying to vaccinate underinsured children in non-legal, you know, essentially legal sites, non-FQHCs and RHCs. But maybe it could be used to vaccinate adults that don't have health insurance. Maybe it can be used in outbreak control where there's just not time to be checking insurance cards. And here you're setting up a mass clinic like Joni did in Colorado for the meninge outbreak. I mean, you weren't able to check insurance cards. You just needed to vaccinate. And then there are other priorities that I know that you would have. But the question is, how do we get from where we are now to there, where we need to be? So a few principles I think might be helpful is, one is that we need to provide a programmatically accountable basis for all federal purchase vaccine. I see this deputization for VFC as a bridge to help get there, because then if deputization becomes allowed and guided, it can become programmatically accountable in here. We need to have a disincentive for these grandfathered plans to stay grandfathered. If we have a way where they just sort of keep getting floated with government purchased vaccine, they're not going to have that incentive to change and to cover vaccines like they need to. Need to provide accountable vaccine for underinsured children in public sector settings while grandfathered plans still exist. Deputization can serve that bridge. I hope that we are successful in that. There's no guarantee that we're going to be successful, but we're going to try that. We want to facilitate dose-level accountability so that we can make progress on provider-level accountability for the vaccine. Like to see stronger health department clinics. This is going to be important for preparedness. I think we're hearing that over and over in this conference. And, you know, this is public health. We need to be able to use evidence to show that we're going in the right direction. We may not need to get there next year or next month or 2 years from now, but we ought to be going in the right direction. We want to be able to find a way that we can show that. So a couple of important changes in transition for the underinsured population. It should be declining. And as I say, a temporary bridge, it would be great if we're able to come out with this guidance and have deputization as an allowable process. The many states who I think are interested in doing it may want to go ahead and feel comfortable doing this as a bridge. It'll be an accountable bridge towards the full ACA impact if deputization is allowed. For fully insured children, private insurance needs to pay regardless of where they go. There was a great, Dwayne did a really nice conference this morning about with the Billables Project, and somebody was saying, you know, and they found out that, you know, the insurance company, they would actually pay us to do this work that we've been doing for free for all these years. You know, I thought that's, you know, the service that the health department clinics provide to the fully insured and then to the program eligible children, it's a major service, you know, and you deserve to be paid for that. And then ideally no Section 317 vaccine except maybe special situations, mass clinics, outbreak controls, and things like that. So I think those are a couple changes. So now I'm going to leave with one, and I've got a couple of conclusions, but sort of a critically important question as we think about accountability going forward. So a key question for you to ask, and this goes back to my first of the four big challenges, that discretionary funding has not been able to keep pace with the need, is can your state And grantee, can your vaccine financing policy be completely supported by your access to discretionary vaccine funding, Section 317 in state or local? So you need to, we need to think hard about that. This question is most germane to a grantee that has greater than VFC only vaccine financing policy. I don't know if, is Jana here? I don't know if I can quote you, but I, tell me if I can't, but I mean, Jana, on a call, Jana, I think you said that that we're all rapidly going to VFC only on one of the calls. I'm pretty sure that was you that said that. And I think that it's very true, but I think that VFC only plus Affordable Care Act insurance can get all children covered. And so we really have to be take a close look. You know, if you're using, you know, is the amount of, the number of children you're trying to cover with discretionary funding, are you able to cover those children with the discretionary funding that you have? And so I think that we have to have a dialogue that we try to answer that question in a shared way between CDC and the immunization programs. And so we have a variety of financing. This is probably old data, and it changes all the time. I remember in Grace Lee's study, she had a diagram of transitions that happened just in the previous year. So one thing that we are doing to try to help, and I think that this shows, and Sonia, I don't know if you'd agree, but I mean, I think this shows sort of bedrock support in Office of Management and Budget and HHS and other places, that they want to see you succeed. They want to see immunization programs succeed. And so the idea that this prevention and public health funding that we did not have access to last year, where those well above us said, you know, immunization needs to have access, needs to help that access in transitioning to an ACA-compliant new environment in here, that support really speaks very loudly. And so there's one-time funding opportunity. It's going to be posted tomorrow, but with 40 days, right, 40 days of it being open. So instead of being posted this week with 30 days, it gets posted this week with 40 days of being open. We'll be able to set up all sorts of times to have discussions with the subject matter experts and you all. But, you know, really to help in this transition into a different future where we have strong immunization programs, but you have the private sector paying its way in a very accountable way. Now, the bottom line is here, the FOA is out. We have not received the funding yet, and you know, that's because there's no... you know, we're still under a continuing resolution. How do I say this properly? I mean, I'm optimistic. You know, Sonia, can I say anything more than I'm optimistic? Okay, that's fair. And hearing that's fair from the financial management office, that's a good sign. The other thing is that OMB approved the funding opportunity announcement as it was, and I think that that was a very good recognition. They're saying, all right, this is going in the right direction. This is good stuff. So three quick conclusions. One is that FY 2011 operations funding is holding steady in face of likely 317 decrement, which, as I said earlier, will be coming from vaccine. These vaccine financing challenges are huge, and they're going to require substantial program change, and the type of program change it's going to require is going to vary from program to program to program. But the future program, childhood program, looks like it could be streamlined, but getting there is going to be very, very difficult, I think. And so with that, I'd love to take questions. Well, thank you.
If you have a question for Lance, please come to the microphone in the center aisle. Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Hi, Lance. Okay, so I have a couple things for you. Of course I do. I feel like a broken record every time I come to one of these meetings. So for those of us who come from states where our governors have wisely chosen to engage in the lawsuit against the ACA, that's the first question I'm going to ask you. What assistance can CDC offer to us? We are still universal today, but as Jana mentioned, we're rapidly on the road, not to VFC only, but universal select. And so one of the questions, number one, is I'm hearing you say between VFC and ACA, we're going to have no trouble. We're going to have trouble, but we're going to have no trouble. Everyone's going to be covered. But the bottom line is when you have a governor who says day one in office, we're not going to play with the ACA, what do we do?
Well, right now, I mean, the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. I think there'll probably be some lawsuits, I would imagine. I don't know if they're going to kind of try to quickly get that resolved in the Supreme Court or whatever. But ultimately, if the ACA goes away, we have to have a different dialogue, I think. In the meantime, if you're talking about if you're not being allowed to apply for the funding opportunity announcement that's going to be posted, I don't know that there's anything that we can do about that, but I sure would like to know so that we can let everybody know in the chain on up to the department if that's really the case. I remember for ERA, there were a couple of states that were saying they weren't going to be able to do anything, and it turned out that they could. So,
and we were one of the states that were questionable about ERA. We did get, of course, obviously ERA. We got the money and the vaccine. And then we had an interoperability grant that was awarded to us, but that was another governor. We have a new governor now, and again, the question remains, and that was my next question, is I see a couple grant opportunities within those program areas. I'm not sure that I will be allowed, quite seriously. So I guess that would be my plea to you, is if there's anything you can do. We not only have a new director, new governor, we also have a new director of our Department of Health. So
making us aware is helpful, because then we can make, you know, CDC Washington aware, we can make the department aware, and all of this. I don't think we can do more than that, and hopefully they'll come. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you know, that basically you can't apply for a grant that's going to help save the lives of the children in the state. That's not a really good position for somebody to take, you know. And the danger is if we get caught up in a much larger discussion, and you know, little old immunizations gets caught up, and children get hurt. That would be a problem. I think just making us aware, I think, would be helpful for starters. And you know, I don't know, Sonia, if you have other advice for that, but I mean, it's a concern, and hopefully it will not happen.
Right. Well, I might be on speed dial.
Okay.
Right. Thanks.
Beth?
Hi. I know you think I'm going to ask about deputization, but I'm not. I do have a couple of questions, and maybe just a comment. When you talk about dose-level accountability, I think a lot of us with registries have it at the patient level. Are you talking about having it at the shipping level?
No, it's at the patient level.
Because you're asking, if we're asking for eligibility.
Well, so for example, if somebody comes in and gets TDAP, MCV4, and HPV, but you don't cover HPV, so you'd want to know that they got two that you cover and one that you didn't cover. And so dose level is in contrast to encounter level, I think. Lorraine must be here. Of course you are. I already saw you earlier. I'm sorry, Lorraine. Anyway, so Lorraine and others have written a letter saying that we need to get standards so that we can have billing categories for dose level account, you know, for essentially dose level accountability, and I think that's sort of a helpful thing. But it's in contrast to an encounter level where you know, I got these five vaccines and I've got this covered for all the vaccines. Well, some of the states don't cover all of the vaccines in this. That's
right.
The contrast.
Okay. I understand then. Okay. The other question I have is about, you say true Medicaid expansion on SCHIP.
Yeah.
I may just be really, I've been ignoring this too, Lance, but okay. But now you're making me think. Is there a definition for true, or is that a course I have to take?
Well, the beauty,
true.
Yeah. The beauty of CHIP and SCHIP is that there are enrollment figures. And so, I mean, you could go on the website and see, you know, how many children you have in one plan versus the other plan. But ideally what would be great would be to go meet with your, you know, check that out and then go meet with your CHIP director and say, because they, you know, they have the names of all the children. I mean, so this is unlike VFC, where it's point of service eligibility determination, they have to enroll and sign up. And so that's why I titled that one slide as Far From Hopeless, because I think that we can get the enrollment figures, you know, well-meaning people, we can sit in a room and sit down and say, all right, well, you have this many children, here's how many are in their first year of life, they'll get these vaccines, da-da-da-da-da, and sort it out what it really ought to be, and I think it'll be more straightforward than we think. And I've gotten very hopeful in talking with the states that we've discussed that there's definitely a path, a way forward that's not going to be unreasonable.
And Beth, one way to think about it is that states that chose Medicaid expansion expanded their eligibility for Medicaid so that more children were eligible for Medicaid, and that's how they approached the CHIP program.
But that doesn't necessarily then have anything to do with CHIP. They just expanded their
right.
Well,
Medicaid
that's how
enrollment.
That's
their answer to it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and if it's purely a Medicaid expansion, like I think Alaska is Medicaid expansion, and Maryland, I think Greg is a Medicaid
right.
expansion program, then it's Medicaid, and so it works like BFC.
Well, we have a state where if you're SCHIP up through age 5, you have a Medicaid card.
This is a big
so
challenge.
So we need
And every state that we talk to, the card, I think, where's Marcel? The difference between the Medicaid card and the SCHIP card was one letter, I think, something like that. Oh, two letters. Oh, piece of cake. Okay. So, yeah, but I mean, they look kind of identical, so okay. It's a
Thank
challenge.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Right. Jana?
And I think it was you that said that, right?
I don't know.
Oh, then maybe if you don't remember, and I'm older than you, that means I'm probably the one that's wrong. So somebody said that on one of our calls.
I could have said it.
So.
I don't mind that you said I said it.
I thought it was a brilliant quote.
Okay.
So.
Okay. So now, thanks, Beth, for introducing the dosage level accountability issue, but it raised another question for me. Given your response, can you just, the difference between a VFC accountability requirement and a capacity level to track dosage based on There's two big differences there, and are you saying that this is going to be a VFC accountability issue, dose level accountability, or what the AIM and ARIS letter I think is proposing, which is HL7 messaging platform for the capacity to track it for those states who need to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to have a reasonable pathway forward, I think, and getting the IT systems in place, it'd be nice if they were in place 10 years ago, and when we need them now that they were all ready. I think we need to really get that pathway forward now. I mean, the vaccines are a certain price now. What if they, you know, what if 10 years down the line they're even worse? So I think we have to have a reasonable way. I think that it's very reasonable to be looking at our IT systems, especially registries, EMRs, registries, that whole, you know, the Anne's beautiful slide. I don't know if you saw it with, you know, all the graphics in here as a way to get information that's going to help with accountability. I think that's going to be one of the key roles for registries. I think several of the grantees we're going to be meeting tomorrow morning at 7 or 7:30 and get a chance to talk a little bit about some of the feasibility of what we can gather now without, you know, we don't want to scare the providers away either. You know, we want to get something that's going to work.
Okay. So, and that was my second point, or not really a question, but just to note that on you have your slide about provider level accountability needing to be strengthened, and I think the big thing that was missing there for me is the potential impact on the provider office. Both with dose level accountability and with any increased accountability. One other question. You made a statement that you think the VFC SCHIP expansion or separate program is more an issue for VFCs states who have gone beyond VFC than it is for VFC-only states, and I would love some conversation about that because I think as a universal state, you're going to find that is less of an issue for us because of the way that we have to manage our funding sources related to our population. So I don't know if other states would feel that way or not, but I would love to put our numbers on the table and show you how.
Okay, yeah, I think the universals
it's less of an
are
issue
in
for
a,
us.
Universals are in I don't know, peculiar situation, but mm-hmm. a different kind of situation.
Maybe it could be in between states.
Yeah, I think it's where we cover underinsured in private provider offices. It becomes I think that's one of the big challenges in there.
Okay. So then the last thing, which is actually the first part of the talk, the comments about funding and operations funding, and thank you. Thank you for sharing the numbers, showing them so clearly, and all the efforts toward keeping us level and understanding how much work it is to get kids vaccinated, and buying the vaccine doesn't solve the problem in and of itself. But my question is really about the formula that you mentioned, and I would love to see the formula that's used to determine the proportionate funding level for states, and also how often are we recalculated every year? Because when you mentioned that capacity or performance is a piece of and population, those for in Washington, those are changing rapidly.
Right. Right.
Luckily, we have increased in rank in state and for immunization rates. And so how often is it recalculated? And then how can we have sort of ongoing communication as we learn what our funding is? Where are we in the process? We have been historically an overfunded state. And so for me, it's really critical that I understand what the long-term decrease in funding is so that I can try to manage us toward that without any, you know, significant loss in staff or significant loss in program ability related to, you know, meeting our objectives and ultimately immunization coverage.
Yeah, so I think it'd be good to have a dialogue over the formula and the principles in the formula. It's like 80% driven by population size. I mean, it's very, very, and I think that performance either low or high gives you a little bit more money, but it only steers like 4 or 5% of the fund. So it's not really a lot. It's something you say, well, gee, we have a performance-driven program, but you know, sort of like a little tiny wheel, and then there's big, you know, the big wheel, and then the other. And so, but I think that it never hurts to have a discussion over the principles of the formula, and also we can share. There's a 2 or 3 page document that gets shared periodically that says how it works, and so we should share that. And it does get calculated every year, you know, in here. And, I don't think there's a horrible problem in sharing the de-identified ranking. I mean, I think it sort of is what it is, you know, but we can certainly share the formula and everything.
That'd be great. Well, and your project officer can tell you where you are relative to everybody else.
Yeah, because the slides here, they say number 1, 2, 3.
Right. Description of the formula is in the IPOM in the basics chapter, the components. And then whenever there are new inputs in terms of population coverage data, whatever, we will always use the most current data for the inputs to the formula.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for your questions, and let's thank Lance.
Thank you.